Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Roy Eisenhart, and it's my honor to be your moderator for today's program with Bruce Bochy, the manager of the world champion San Francisco Giants. Those of you who are familiar with the Commonwealth Club know that you can go on the internet at their website, commonwealthclub.org, and find, among other things, upcoming programs and rebroadcasts of many of the previous programs. We're honored today to have Bruce Bochy representing the world champion Giants, and we're honored to San Francisco to have them be our team. A little bit about Bruce before he comes out. Of course, he's well known as the steady, charismatic gentleman who just seems to go with the flow, whatever is going on in a game. But beyond that, Bruce has had an interesting and diverse career in baseball. He started as a player, of course, and played principally for Houston and the San Diego Padres. And in 1995, he took over as the manager of the Padres and managed there until he came up and managing the Giants. He's won the National League Manager of the Year two times. And among active managers, he has the third most wins of all the active managers today. This will be his 19th, or was his 19th, it will be his 19th year as managing, starting in 1995. Did I do my math correctly? So, without further ado, I would ask you to welcome Bruce Bochy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, now you know what it's like to be a rock star.
Oh, I tell you what, I have a little bit more of a comfort zone here than yesterday. I had to swing a golf club yesterday down at Pebble to help raise some money. We had a shootout with the 49ers, and I'm not much of a golfer, but I'm on the first tee. And I look out there to hit the ball, and there's four or five guys right in the fairway going to take my picture right on line where I'm going to hit. Of course, they're lined up on the left and right. Yeah. And I'm telling you, I missed a guy. It had to be that much. And I'm like, oh. But anyway, we got through it. The Giants won, and we did raise some money.
So. Good. Yeah. The Giants always win. That seems to be kind of an expectation now. Has adrenaline gone out of your system yet after last season?
Yeah, sure it has. You know, it has to, really. Last year it's a season that we'll all look back and we'll savor those memories, but you know, your success is never final. You got to move on, and that's where we're at right now. And you know, once that Super Bowl ends and we know it's our time to go to work, and yeah, there'll be a lot of hoopla in the spring. Mm-hmm. We know that, but at the same time, we have to remind ourselves it's a new year, new season, new race, and we need to get ready. And so we got some work to do. And you know, thanks to Brian, we have most of our guys back. But we know how hard it is to get back and repeat. Although I still think if we didn't lose Posey in 2011, we really would have had a chance to. Who had done it back to back and maybe 3 years in a row.
Your phrase is interesting, that about success being temporary in baseball is an interesting one. And what I'd like to do is build on that and roll back to the time, the year 1995, when you first took over managing the San Diego Padres. Because to remind people, that was a very turbulent year in baseball. The 1994 World Series had been canceled because of a labor strife. The rolled into spring training with the owners threatening to unilaterally impose bargaining conditions on the players, and players were still out. The owners threatened to use replacement players. So there you are. The good news is you're now the manager for the first year, and the bad news is all the players are on strike. What a way to start.
Well, I'll be honest. That was a really difficult time for me, my first year managing. My general manager who hired me for the first time was a man named Randy Smith. His father was Tal Smith, who was my general manager in Houston back in 1978 when I came up with them. But when Randy hired me, he said, you know, we're looking at a strike. And so for me, my first year, I was concerned going into a spring training, running a camp with these replacement players. And they came out of the woodwork, let me tell you. Even reporters, Henry, we had a couple of those, which was good because we could see, you know, really, you know, their talents too. But I was really concerned about credibility.
Yeah.
You know, I was getting my team for the first time. And to get in front of them and, you know, talk about what we want to accomplish for the season, I just finished running to camp with replacement players. I wasn't real comfortable with that. I was fortunate because Randy understood that. So instead of me running the camp, my trusted friend, who is my third base coach here, Tim Flannery, I put him in charge of running the camp. Yeah. And so I pretty much let Tim handle the replacement players, and he understood. He was fine. And we had some fun with it, even though we knew you know, eventually this thing would get get taken care of. But, you know, as we talked about earlier, we learn from it. I mean, baseball, it needs its best. You're not going to come out and watch replacement players. So I think that's the last time we've had an issue.
Right. Yeah, the NFL had tried it in 87, and then the NFL tried it again with replacement referees this year, and it never seems to quite work. Mm-hmm. Just to round out the history so that you all know that what happened, it was towards the end of spring training. The federal district court told the owners they couldn't do this, and so they 2 days later they settled it, and the season was shortened. It was 144 games, but it was still your first season. You finished third with the team, which was in the following year you finished first in the
division. Right. We actually made a lot of ground. We made a great trade with Houston. That's when we got Steve Finley and Caminiti and kind of brought baseball back down in San Diego. They went through some really difficult years and cut back to payroll, but we made a lot of progress. And really up until the 1st of September, we were right in the middle of the race and faded right there at the end. And for me, that's important for a first-year manager. It's important that you somehow you hang in there or play good baseball, because you really don't know if you're going to get that second chance. We had a new owner come in, John Moores, and for us to make that kind of ground, Larry Lucchino, because Randy Smith, I'll back up a little bit, he went on to Detroit after that year. And I had a one-year contract with an option for 96. So I didn't know if I was coming back or not. In fact, we had just finished playing the Giants, and we were flying back to San Diego. Season's over. I don't know what's going on. Randy's going to Detroit. I don't know if I have a job. Yeah. And Larry Lucchino, he handed me this envelope and said that they're going to take up my option. And then, like you said, in 96, we went on to win the division. Yeah. And that kind of helps you at least get a little established for a young manager. And that's kind of how my career got going.
But it makes it a bigger point about baseball, the insecurity of it. You know, I mean, as you said, success is fleeting, and it's for the players. If they're successful 3 times out of 10, that's success. For a manager, a record of over a little over 500 wins, as you have, is 500 percentage. I mean, is tremendous.
It was, especially where we came from. So I'm sure that helped me get my option taken up and give me a little security. Although back then, a one-year contract with an option was pretty much the norm. And now basketball, football, and even baseball, they're getting longer terms. But there's a lot of pressure. And at that time, I did everything. I ran all the meetings, the pitcher meetings, the hitting meetings, and you know, I said, well, if this doesn't work, it's gonna be at least I'll go out saying I did it my way, and probably over the over time, you delegate a little bit better, and I have an unbelievable coaching staff here, and and really you'd burn yourself out if you tried to do it all like I did that first year, but that's back before. We had who I call our propeller heads that give us all the stats and guys that, even our advanced scouts. Yeah. I had color pens, and each hitter, after the game, I'd stay in the office, and I would chart where they hit the ball off that pitcher, and then you would stay there. That's how you did things.
Yeah.
But now it's all done for you. So life's a little bit easier now.
Yeah. Easier and harder. The more data there
is.
You
get more information, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So I think it'd be interesting if you, now that you can be a historian, having this bridge, this period from 95 to now, and you're obviously going to keep going, what change do you see in the way you approach managing from when you first started? I don't mean just experience-based, but I mean the way you deal with players, the way you deal with the press, the whole dynamics.
Well, I think hopefully you do. You learn from your experiences that you've had as far as dealing with players. The biggest difference in the game now, obviously, is the media, the social media. The information that's out there. You have pretty much everything we have. Even if you go back and listen to a baseball game, Kurt Gowdy did, for example. I mean, Kurt he told you pretty much what you were looking at. Yeah. But now you watch a baseball game and you have all the announcers giving you the stats, percentages, and when I or any manager does something against that, he's going to point it out. So I think that's the biggest difference. Yeah. As far as dealing with your players, that really hasn't changed, I don't think. I mean, hopefully you've gotten better and you've learned from some mistakes, but that's the biggest part of, I think, our job, whether it's a head coach in football, basketball, or baseball, is managing. That's what it is, managing your people. Running the game, we all have our own style maybe, but there's certain absolutes that you have to do in this game. But it's keeping your players hopefully prepared and putting them in a position to where they can do well.
Well, but just to push back slightly, there was a period of time, particularly around the time you started managing, where the so-called intimidating manager was in style, the Earl Weaver, who recently passed away, the Billy Martin style, and that doesn't seem to work anymore.
Well, I think two things there, Roy. I think if you go back to their days, you didn't have the long-term contracts that these players have now. You know, some of them over $100 million. You know, it's hard to bully a guy like that. You're not going to threaten him. Yeah. He'll go to Triple A because he knows they're not going to send me Triple A making $20, $30 million a year. That doesn't work. It still works to a point. I think you still have to be demanding and have discipline. And the players, they do want to be disciplined. But I think that the players now, I think they're a little more educated in the business itself, the game, and they want to know. And you just can't yell it at them. And I'll use Buster Posey, for example. Buster, I mean, he's off the chart, makeup, but when you tell him something, he wants to know why. Mm-hmm. He wants to learn, and I think on the average, players are more like that now. You know, it's not a yes or no thing, and they need to have things explained to them sometimes. And that doesn't mean that you can't drop the hammer on them, which you have to sometimes. But I think you have to spend a little bit more time explaining.
Do you think the fact you were a catcher gives you a better insight into the entirety of the game and the ability to explain, not just to Posey, but to all the players and the pitchers?
Oh, I think without question. There's always a lot of talk about how many catchers are managing, and that transition from player to manager is so much easier for a catcher because, in essence, That's what he is during the game. He's the guy that sees everything going on. He's got to get the signs from the manager. He's handling a pitching staff, so he's got to learn to deal with 11 or 12 different personalities. He's got to know all the bunt plays, all the defenses. He's got to get the signs again on what needs to be done. So that's why I think it makes it easier. As a catcher, we can never drift back there mentally. Sometimes in the outfield, you see a guy working on his stance, and, you know, after he just popped up. Well, can you see a catcher doing that?
Yeah.
It doesn't work. So he's got to keep his focus on calling a game. It's so important to manage that staff. And so I think that's what makes it easier, why you see more catchers. And, you know, we probably are more of a grinding group than the rest of them. But, you know, there's great managers who weren't catchers. I'm just saying it makes it easier.
No, I understand. It's a relative thing. You manage two World Series teams now here, World Series winning teams, which is important, 2010 and 12. How would you compare those two teams?
Yeah. Really, I'd say they're very similar. Yeah, we put a mantra, you know, on this year's team, you know, the never say die attitude. But the 2010 team was similar.
Here, let me help you.
Thank you. You know, I think in that respect, you know, the teams were very much alike. The pitching staff on both clubs were very similar, although we probably had a little more offense with this past club in 2012, not the power that we had in 2010. I mean, there are some differences, but the makeup of the club itself, I thought they were similar. You know, we called them misfits in 2010. Well, we had them in 2012 too. I mean, you look at Hunter Pence, and you know, he's giving his speeches, and Romo, and they were, you know, so very, very unique in their style, how they play together. They're a very unselfish group, which is very uncommon in professional sports. Because, you know, I did ask, you know, guys to step out of their role in 2010, just like 2012, but they accepted it, like Timmy going to the bullpen. I mean, he didn't waver on it. Yeah, hey, whatever. I just want to help us get to the World Series and win, and you know, things like that. And when Wilson went down, we went to bullpen by committee. And there's some egos down there. Believe me, there's a couple of guys that wanted that closing role. And when I took Casilla out of that closing role, hey, whatever. I just want to help the club. And I think you know, that's the reason both clubs did so well, because they were so unselfish and they had one thing in mind.
Yeah, but there was an interesting difference. It may not be a distinction, but a difference, and that is the 2012 team was never behind. I mean, when you got into the playoffs, you were always ahead. You had twice. Is that wrong? Am I being correct?
No, going to the postseason.
Yeah, in the postseason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
Well, we clinched early in 2012. We weren't behind
in the playoffs.
I mean, we were to the Dodgers early in 2012, but once.
Well, this is the point I want to make. You were down 2-0 to Cincinnati. You were down 3-1 to St. Louis. And that's something the 2010 team didn't have to do. And I'm interested in the character that you had, the quality you had in this year's team that was able to mobilize themselves and overcome that kind of an adversity.
Well, that's why I came up with the tagline, the Never Say Die group, because they did have their backs to the wall. I mean, six times you're facing elimination, and that's pretty amazing. I am amazed, as long as I've been in this game, and a lot of things have to go right. You know, we talk a lot about that third game and meetings and the things that we had. But if you look back at that game, it's not like, you know, we came out firing. We got one hit, nine innings. Bailey and the guy that, you know, the unsung hero through it all for me, I mean, we talk about Zito, was Vogelsong, who pitched that game. And kept us in there, 1-1, and we finally got a break there in the 10th inning. But it was a group that they weren't going to be denied. They didn't want to go home, and that they and Pence kept reminding that pretty much every day. And
but you, I mean, you. Let's be honest. The first two games here against Cincinnati, it didn't look great.
They were awful. You can see that.
I was waiting for you to fill in.
No, they were.
So you, I mean, you're the manager, right? And you're going to Cincinnati. It's an elimination game. You had to take some initiative there, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember when we got to Cincinnati. You know, you're trying to get the mood, the tempo, the spirit of the club, and sometimes I would check with the staff and just to see where they're at. And I know Bam Bam and Roberto Kelly said, they're doing okay, but they probably need a little bit more. And so, I'm thinking of how I'm going to approach this, and it's easy to get up there and say, okay, we can do it, but you. Again, you got to explain, or hopefully give them hope. So, I'm coming up with what I'm going to say, and we talk about how we can do it and how it's been done in baseball, going from even Boston, but other teams that have come from behind, and even broke out this Gideon story.
What is that story?
Well, Gideon was a man that God had chose to free the Israel from the Midianites. Mm-hmm. And It's a great story about going against all odds, and which we were doing.
Yeah.
And eventually, I mean, started out with 32,000 men, and God had told him, you have too many men. Some of them have to lead, so ask who's afraid. And he asked who's afraid, and I think some, and my numbers might be a little off here, but it got down to 10,000. He said, you still have too many men. So they had this fervor test, which test of how committed they were. They had to go down and drink water, and how they drank the water is would determine whether they would be eliminated or not, and whether they drank the water and they lapped it with their hand, or they just went down and drank it and didn't watch the enemy. And somehow they got down to 300 men, and Gideon's going, well, how can I do this? I'm shortening this story up a little bit, so we're not spending too much time on it. But anyway, they surrounded the camp of the Midianites, they had over 100,000 men, and they had a trumpet and a horn, and they had a lantern there, and they made enough noise to where they confused the Midianites, and they thought they were surrounded by thousands of Gideon's men, and so they end up killing themselves, running away. Anyway, they won, and so this was the gist of the whole story. With Jeremy Affelt, who is really a strong Christian, he knew the story, and he said, "God, you were right on." He goes, "The one thing you forgot was a fleece," and this is when Gideon was trying to see if this was really God, if this is really going to happen, and had the fleece when the dew in the morning. If the fleece was dry that day, then God was sending him the message. So to back that up, he says, "Well, God, how about the next day? The grass is dry and the fleece is wet," and that's what happened. Yeah. So that's when he knew that he was being led by God. So. But I didn't mean to get too long there.
The point is that a story like that, you chose to tell that story to the players, and that it resonated, right?
Well, again, we were going against all odds, so I'm trying to, I'm trying to think,
yeah.
And this was a great story that I knew that I had remembered, so I broke it. And I had to go back and make sure I had some of my facts right.
Correct.
So, but I did hedge a little bit, because I told him I did hedge. I said, it's been done before, but really it had never been done in the National League, where a team had gone on the road and had to beat a team three times. So I did tell him after the game.
Yeah.
I said, after we won the series, I did hedge a little bit there.
We actually, when you were playing with the Padres, you played in that in 84, you were down 2-0 to the Cubs, right? In
right.
a 5-game playoff.
But we came home.
Yeah.
See, that
but
that
that's
different.
A yeah. fine difference. I mean, you still had to win 3 in a row.
Right.
So
right.
so you actually were there yourself.
Yeah, and I brought that up to him. I said, mm-hmm. you know, Flan and I were with the Padres, and we got pummeled by the Cubs in 84, those first two
yeah.
games. I mean,
13-0 or something.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, a good friend of mine, Sutcliffe, he pitched that game and hit a home run, but anyway, we went back, won 3 games. Durham had the ground ball go through his legs, and
yeah.
we got a couple of breaks there, but came back and beat him.
That's the point, yeah.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting that you could, I mean, I think this goes to the point of the modern manager, that you could actually take your team and tell them a story like that, and it would work.
Well, you know, I don't know if that worked. Believe me, again, we're going back. I'm trying to think yeah. how I can give them hope.
Yeah.
And then that's when Hunter came up, and Hunter just right. gave this unbelievable yeah. emotional speech, and he told him how much he loved him. He didn't want to go home. He wasn't ready to go home. He wanted to see what Terry O was going to be wearing the next day. And, yeah. I mean, we don't know what he said. Yeah. It's just the way he said it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he did a yeah. good job of firing the troops up. Yeah. I said, Hunter, if I know you'd do that, I would have cut mine way short.
Yeah.
So, yeah. like I said, though, we went out and got one hit for 9 innings. So I think only the pitchers were listening.
Yeah. Well, that just to dwell a little more on that team's overall character. I mean, they had a way of. I mean, you left out the fact that you lost your best hitter during the middle of the year too, or at least in terms of average in Cabrera. So that team had a lot of adversity to deal with, and they seemed to rise to it.
They did, and that's probably what I'm as proud of as anything is what they had to go through because. As you know, when Melky went down, Melky was—he could have been our best player at that time. I mean, he was just having an unbelievable year, and that's about the same time that the Dodgers spent all that money on that trade with Boston. So, you know, with you know the players dealing with Melky going down, the Dodgers situation, the naysayers coming out, the Giants are done, and I remember Brian and I just went in front of the club. And I, Melky, we had spoken to earlier, but he wasn't comfortable. He said, "You know what? I'll text the guys or call them." But so Brian and I just said, you know, some quick words that, "Hey, guys, we got the talent here. You know, you can do this. You got something to prove now." And you know, it wasn't one guy that is the reason we're in this situation right now. And that's when we had some unbelievable play, of course, from Pagan and yeah. Scudero and Posey, and just like you know, the guys all came together. Pablo Sandoval, you know, he was coming on from his surgery, getting stronger,
mm-hmm.
and Crawford just gelled together. And Crawford, yeah. Belt, everybody just started playing better,
yeah.
and that's the only way it happens.
Well, in fact, it was not shortly. It was shortly after that you went down to L.A. and swept the Dodgers 3 straight, right? I think that's right.
Yeah, and we were kidding that they might make another deal here after all that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes they can make too many deals. I mean, you know.
Oh, you can.
Yeah.
You can. And, you know, they're going to be tough this year. We know it, but it takes time sometimes. Our game's a funny game. Mm-hmm. You can have too many stars or it not quite happen, as you've seen with the Yankees on certain years.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a matter of everybody doing something to contribute, and that's
yeah.
kind of how it happened for us.
Well, that's kind of why I liked your team so much this year, because notwithstanding all the data, just the notion of taking a bunch of guys and paying them high salaries and putting them together and throwing their mitts out on the field, it has never proven to work. But what's proven to work is the kind of combination that you ended up with, where guys play as a team. You need to get a runner over, you get a runner over. And it doesn't matter, you know, about batting average or incentive bonuses or anything like that. And that's what aesthetically, your team was a fantastic team to watch in terms of baseball. And
well, that's the greatest compliment you can have as a coach or anybody, a player on the team or myself. And I got that compliment in the winter meetings that how impressed they were, how we did play as a team. What bothered me more than anything, probably as we're going through this, is the word lucky. We kept hearing, well, we're getting the bounces. We were lucky. Blanco's bunt, the play at home plate where Buster got fielder. But really, I thought we won because of the fundamentals that we executed so well. And all that goes back to spring training and the work during the year. So that's why you're, as a coach or manager, that's why you're proud of the club. Because of the little things we did. I mean, our defense was off the chart. I mean, Blanco was frustrating all their hitters making those plays out there.
Yeah.
Laying bunts down, the hit and runs. Vogelsong's hit and run with the man on. And one that doesn't get mentioned, the last inning. I mean, we finally had to come back in that series. We got down that last game against Detroit. But Crawford had to go up there and lay a bunt down off a left-hander throwing 95. That's not easy.
No.
But every day going out there and practicing that, from spring training on, he laid down a perfect bunt to set it up for Scudero to get the winning hit. And that's what you feel good about as a coach and manager, that you executed the fundamentals. And we weren't a team that could slug it with the other team. We knew that, but we had to play the game of baseball, and we had to play together.
Yeah. And that's why I say not just did you win, but you won with an aesthetic quality that baseball fans really appreciate. So let's talk about what you see going into the future just a bit, and then we'll go to audience questions. How do you see your team shaping up going into this season?
Well, I like where we're at right now. I have to, because we pretty much have our club back. That's a good thing. The pitching, have this rotation set again. That's really the reason why we've had so much success is what our starters do. And I know Timmy had an up and down year, but I really look for him to bounce back. I think having success in the postseason, coming out of the bullpen, is going to help his confidence. Zito, it was great to see how he bounced back last year and had a big year for us, won 15 games, and not just in the postseason. This guy won some huge games for us during the season. So, to have those five going every fifth day, that's a nice luxury. And we've been very fortunate on knock on wood, and our conditioning guys do a great job of keeping these guys in shape. And Dave Righetti does a great job of just monitoring these guys so we do have them the whole year. Bullpen, what happened last year has to give us confidence when Romo does what he did, or Casilla, Affelt. So, we like where we're at with the bullpen. And
you added Ramirez.
Yeah, we just signed him as a non-roster. We'll take a look at him, so he'll be trying to make the club.
But it's a nice problem to have.
It is, because here's another guy that's accustomed to pitching late in the game. Now, we'll see where he's at as far as his stuff in spring training, but it's nice to have depth and these options as we go into camp. And really, if you look at our club, left field, we signed Torres to help out there, but that'll be the one spot that, as I always say, we'll go deep in the spring before we'll know what's going to happen there. But with Pagan in center, Pence in right, we're pretty well set there. In the infield, we're set. And now it's a matter of getting these guys in shape and ready to go. And look forward to seeing Pablo. I understand he's here in San Francisco. So kind of see how much work we got to do with him. But other than that, I'm comfortable.
Well, you have kind of a wild card this year with the World Baseball Classic. A lot of your players won't be in spring training for a while, will they?
Right. And we're going to have to really keep a watchful eye on these guys when they leave. It's also to have them ready. Vogelsong was down throwing in Pebble. He and Matt Cain went to a high school field. Now, can you imagine these high schoolers practicing, and all of a sudden here comes Matt Cain and Vogelsong play catch in Pebble? I'm sure they got a treat there. But we have to make sure they're ready. Pitchers are the biggest concern with this WBC, and these guys want to represent their countries, and but we Casilla, Romo from the pitching side, Jeremy Affelt, Lopez. So we have quite a few. And on the position side, I know Pablo, Scudero. Who am I leaving out, Henry? There's a few of them. But it's going to be a little different spring in that respect. I think we're going to have 37, 38 pitchers in camp to make sure we cover ourselves and not push anybody. But you know, opening days on the 1st, we start our first workout, pitchers and catchers, on the 12th. Mm-hmm. So we're starting earlier this year.
Yeah.
Pagan, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, let's take some. We have about a fistful of dollars here with regard to audience questions, and it's going to be hard for me to sort through them and pick them out, but just start with the one right on top. What do you feel about Lincecum returning to starting rotation?
Well, as I just talked about, I feel good about Timmy going back in the starting rotation. You know, it doesn't matter how good you are in any sport. You probably, at some point, you're going to have, you know, hiccup or up and down year, and Timmy did, and you learn from it. And like I said, I think he really gained a lot of confidence coming out of the bullpen, so I'm excited about seeing him back in the rotation.
I'm going to, because some of these are matters that we talked about during your discussion. This brings up an issue that I think is interesting. The problem of, or I'll call it a problem, that's tipping my hand, of players using social media during or after the game, and how you feel about that.
I do have concern, to be honest. You know, the social media, it can be dangerous. I know it's a great tool to get instant information, particularly for, you know, people who are in the media. They want to know something, or fans. For me, for a manager, you want to have a clubhouse, the culture in a clubhouse, in a way that it's a sanctuary for them, where they feel comfortable. They don't have to worry about anything getting out. What happens there stays there. That's a time for them to, you know, console each other or kick each other in the tail if needed, whatever. But you want it to stay there. And that's something I will talk about in the spring, which I normally do, because you have to be careful once you have a meeting or something happens in there and a player gets right out and Twitters it, and, you know, you can't pull it back. And that's how you really can start some trouble in that clubhouse.
Well, there are about seven questions here about Brian Wilson, and I know you've dealt with that recently, but let's deal with it one more time. Will Wilson be back?
I can't say that he'll be back. I can't say the door's closed on Brian Wilson. We have past texts, and I really don't know where he's at right now as far as throwing. I don't know where he's at as far as what he's going to do. You know, these are decisions that are made by Brian. I know Brian Sabian, and I know he came out and said it didn't look, I don't know the exact quote, but it didn't look good, Brian coming back and being with us. But I don't think that's completely shut. So I wish I had more for you, but that's all I have.
Let me take a moment and remind our radio audience who are listening in that you're listening to Bruce Bochy, the manager of San Francisco Giants, on Commonwealth Club noontime series. And we've been chatting with Bruce about the history and the future for the San Francisco Giants. This is a question that interests me, as unfortunately it's asked by somebody else, and that is the whole use of TV cameras in the dugout and the almost like the way that the camera being in there changes the culture and the behavior inside the dugout. There's no privacy anymore, I guess the way I'll put it.
No, it does. I know it changes. It changed me, because I know when something goes wrong, that camera's right on me to see.
That's right.
And see what I'm going to say or kick or whatever. And you know, I know a lot of you say, well, how... how can you be so calm through all this? Yeah. Don't let that belie what's going on underneath. I know that camera's on me, and I'm trying trying to keep my cool. If you ever see me walk down, and sometimes I head down, then there's probably something being thrown. The players are aware of it. Some of them love it. Some of them take advantage of it. It's like, who's that guy? Where's Waldo? You'll see one or two players always look for the camera.
Yeah.
They manage to find it. And we accuse Jeremy Affeld of being one of those, by the way.
Yeah.
It really has changed the game. The end game stuff that we do, I don't agree with it, to be honest, but it's part of baseball now. You know, you're managing a game, and, you know, the bottom of the fourth, you know you have to do an in-game media deal. It just, you know, it's a distraction, but it's something that's changed in the game. And I know players, I didn't know, one time this year, I looked down at Romo, he's down there doing an in-game deal. And he's available. Usually they get somebody on the disabled list or a starting pitcher. I got my closer down there, like the fifth inning, goofing off, whatever. But again,
well, he had his thing where he'd get behind another person being interviewed, too.
Right. Yeah. So, but it makes you a lot more careful in the dugout.
Yeah, I would suspect. Well, you had, I guess it wasn't this year, but the year before, you had that ESPN deal on the Giants where they followed you all year. Was that
Showtime?
Intrusive Showtime.
Yeah, that was Showtime. You know, actually, that came out. It came out a lot better than I thought as far as how it was handled. They really stayed behind the scenes, and you know, they would come for 2 weeks, leave for 2-3 weeks. I thought they did a pretty good job as far as their coverage on the players and bringing out their personalities. I thought it was well done. Now, the last year with the Marlins, I thought was disastrous. With all that happened down there, and they end up having to shut that down early, I heard. But with the problems they had, I don't think it showed a good light in baseball.
It's a risky gamble. I mean, with a team like yours,
we worried about it. I'll be honest. I mean, we agreed, and being on the West Coast, a lot of fans. Baseball fans, on the East Coast, whatever, didn't know a lot about our guys. So, and some guys participated, some didn't. Like Lincecum didn't. You didn't see Posey in it very much to the home plate collision. Then you saw a lot of them.
Yeah.
But then you had other guys that loved it. They had a lot of fun with it.
This is an interesting question. The use of instant replay. I mean, once upon a time, there was none. Now it's growing. What's your feeling about it?
I'm for it. I'm for getting the plays right. Now I know you have to limit this. There's nothing more frustrating than to lose a game, and we have the technology to change that call and get it right. And I go back to 2010. We had to win the last game to get to the postseason. Well, we lost a game earlier in that year playing the Mets where Ishikawa was safe at home plate, and he was called out. Well, that game could have been the difference between us getting to the postseason or not. So I've told them. They know where I stand. I'm for it. There's ways I think we can do this where it's not going to draw it out. I wouldn't be against throwing a flag, whether you get one or two and going that way. I know they're 50-50 on how a manager would do it, but I would be for it, like football. I think it works for football.
I guess it's where you draw the line. For example, you wouldn't want to replay on a check swing.
Okay? No. You would have to. You know what? I'd plays at the plate I'm really big on because it happens so fast. And we got the call with the fielder last year in the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine if we don't get the call? There's no replay. Now they got one run in, nobody out, and they have a man in scoring position. That's a completely different game.
Yeah.
So this is my point. At home plate, it happens so fast that sometimes they get turned around. They're trying to avoid the catcher or the runner, and dirt flying, they don't see it.
Yeah.
So I'm big on home plate, and foul and fair balls. trap plays, I would have no problem.
Fan interference.
And even a play on the base where the umpires are for this. Believe me, they're all for it. They don't want to have to answer questions after the game. So they said we're about getting it right too. But if there's a play where the umpire could be honest and not put it on his partner, going, "I didn't see it. How about you?"
Yeah.
That's what they don't want to do. But if you had replay, they can say, "Hey, you know what? Let's check it. I'm not really sure."
There are several questions on this point about using rookies. Let's take Crawford and Belt, not as specific examples to talk about, but as examples of the larger question, and that is the degree to which you can put a rookie out there and realize they're going to fail for a while, but know that their self-confidence is enough that they can deal with a failure and they're gradually going to play up to their potential, versus burying a guy, and how you get a sense of the difference.
Yeah, a very difficult call. And sometimes you get labeled, which I have at times, that you don't have patience for young players. Which I like young players. I really believe the game's becoming a young players' game. The way we're cleaning it up, it's easier for them to grind through 162 games versus a veteran player now. With what you're asking, it's really it's a gut. It's a consensus between the general manager, the manager, and the coaches on where you're at with that player. I know Belt went up and down, but we really thought we were at a point where he was just killing himself. Brandon Belt, to give you a quick story on him, he had a tough time in Arizona. First series there, and he went back in and had another tough series, but he was really having a tough time defensively and offensively. And we sat down and we talked, and he said, "You know what, there's a time when you put your big boy pants on, let's go. I'm not going to rest you. I'm not going to protect you. We need you out there. He's our shortstop." And where Belt, it's a little easier because Buster can go to first, or Pablo makes it a little easier to make a move like that too. But I think you go with your past experiences with young players, and you got to listen to your coaches, your general manager also, but eventually it's going to be your call.
Yeah. Crawford's a good example of where he came on towards the last half of the season. And
he really did. I'm really proud of how he matured as a player. And he got better in his overall game defensively. That second half, I don't know who played a better short than Brandon Crawford.
Yeah.
I mean, and the way he handled the bat, it really came on. And so he really did a nice job of, not getting down. This game's so hard when things aren't going right. And you start, that self-doubt creeps into you. But he handled it well, and he did a good job with it.
Yeah, that's the point we were talking about earlier, that it's really a failure sport. I mean, if you go up there and you hit 2.8 hits every 10 times at bat, you're
right.
A superstar. And what other, I wouldn't want my airline pilot to land the plane at that rate.
No.
And but yet, so they have to expect failure and deal with it.
Right, right. And you try to let them know that, too, that, hey, you know that you're going to have your ups and we know you're going to have your ups and downs. We know you're going to have your struggles, but we're there. And but at the same time, when you have to make a move and send them down, then you got to try to do it in a positive way. Hey, you're going to be back up here. Let's just get your confidence back and get you back on track. Sometimes it doesn't happen though, because it's all confidence. I'm telling you, in our game, when that talent, when they're Triple-A, Major League, they're very close, but it's that guy that has that little swagger and that confidence. He's cocky enough to get through those rough periods. And it's like any sport, though. You miss a two-footer on a golf course, and you got to make it next time. And that's what separates the good players from the great players.
Several people compliment you on a particular skill that you demonstrate, which is the seeming know when to pull the pitcher and when not to pull the pitcher. And I wonder if you could comment on kind of the thought process that you go through. Let's make it a starter. I'm not talking about relievers. Let's make it a starting pitcher and the thought process that you engage in that.
Yeah, I don't know if my starters will agree with you, though.
Well, I'm just reading the question.
No, I'm good. They're good. Every time you go get them, I'm good.
I know
you are. Yeah. I don't know why you took me out.
Yeah.
Well, there's three runners on base. That's why you're out of this.
You walked them all. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think more than anything, it's again, it's your gut. You've been from playing the game, from catching. You know, I manage in the minor leagues. All that experience is what I go with. I'm not, as you know, we let our starters go. We're not real strict on the pitch count, but there's times when I want them to learn how to get out of a jam. I don't want them looking at the bullpen when they get in trouble in the sixth or seventh inning all the time. Every game's a little bit different. How hard are they laboring in that game? The game before may play a part in it. I might have let them go nine innings, throw 125 pitches. So this game, I want to take it easy on them. Or, it could be two or three games. It's just a gut feeling. I've got a great pitching coach who I talk to constantly.
What about Posey?
Buster and I do a lot of talking, especially in the postseason. I take it back to 2010, with Timmy in that final game, because I had Wilson. I could let Timmy finish. I had Wilson, and I'm sitting there with Buster, and Buster says, I think it's time, so I'll check with him, and he's really good about it because you're back there catching. You know when he's not quite getting a movement or he's lost a little of command, and so Buster really is somebody that we rely on more and more. He's even in spring training, I let him run the running games now. And what I mean by that, I don't go through my signs because I want him to pick up things, and he's sharp enough to do it himself.
You got an amazing guy in Posey.
He is a really. Again, makeup off the chart, but just he gets it. He gets the game. He's got a great feel, not just hitting, but the catching part. He's got a great way of dealing with the pitchers.
Speaking of that, there was a lot of controversy around the plate in 2011, and there's been discussion about protecting a catcher. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I'm still trying to get this rule change. In fact, I talked to Tony about it. The Russa in the winter meetings. I know Joe has his stance on it, but in football, when there's a penalty called, it's usually because that player is defenseless. Quarterback, whoever, receiver. A quarterback is defenseless at times, and if he gets in front of the home plate, now he's giving you home plate. You can't hunt the catcher. You got to go at home plate, and they're not doing that. They're still going after the catcher, and I think that's what we got to change. Because I am getting, I've said this, they're going to carry. I mean, not just a catcher off the field, but he's going to get paralyzed because you get hit in the head area by a human being, 200 plus pounds running full speed. You don't have a chance. And I've been hit a number of times. I understand that's part of the game, but. There should be a little area in there where the runner cannot cross that line, especially when he's rounding third base. And you're rounding third base, you got the foul line. You shouldn't be able to cross back into the line and hit the catcher. You've already came this way, and your direction toward home plate is in foul territory. You shouldn't be allowed to cross that line and hit the catcher if he's not blocking home plate on you. Now, what they argue is the catcher can take the ball and then take the plate away. Well, if he's not that close to home plate, he can't do it. It's almost impossible. Now, sure, he may show him half the plate. Well, now you're open game as a catcher.
Yeah.
If you're in front of any part of the plate, okay, you're open game. But if you're completely in front of it, you can't go at him.
Imagine getting hit by Prince Fielder.
Well, if you remember how Prince got on base, Bumgarner hit him. Now we get a mad guy on first base, and Prince. I know Prince, and that's, he takes joy out of hitting catchers. Yeah. In fact, we had a catcher years ago before I came here. He ended his career, and he tried to hit Whiteside just a couple of weeks after Posey got hurt in 2011, but Whitey stood him up pretty good. But yeah. We had somebody that wanted to hit him.
And I still hate watching Pete Rose hit Ray Fosse in the All-Star game.
It just makes you sick. You know?
What would the sanction be? Runner be out?
Similar, yeah. You fine him, he'd be out of the game. Yeah. There'd be a fine, sure.
Oh, okay, so he's not out at the plate, but he's out of the game.
No, I think you have to call him out at the plate.
Yeah, okay. So here's a very personal question, and that is, how are you going to wear two rings at once?
Yeah. My wife won't let me put it on this one. So. No, you know what? I'll mix it up, but I probably will still. The first one, there's nothing like it. Not the second. Believe me, how special that was on how we got it done. But I'll mix them up. I had the second one measured for the same finger, so I'll change it up a little bit. But, you know what? I'll reserve that comment until I see the second one. How's that? I'll put pressure on Mr. Bear.
You don't want to make news today.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank our audience and tell our radio audience you've been listening to Bruce Bochy, manager of the San Francisco Giants, discuss both his career and the potential future for the San Francisco Giants. And, Bruce, we want to thank you very much for a wonderful dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay, Bruce.
Ready?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be here with such a special group of people. Yeah. I thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.